Welcome to this Science Progress podcast. My name is Jonathan Moreno. I'm editor-in-chief of Science Progress, and I'm here today with Caroline Wagner, who is a senior analyst at SRI International and one of America's leading thinkers about science policy. Dr. Wagner has a new book called The New Invisible College, and we're going to be talking with Caroline about that for the next few minutes. Welcome, Caroline.
Thank you, Jonathan.
So I love the title, The New Invisible College. It's very evocative. Science policy books are not necessarily carriers of the most fascinating titles. This is definitely not a wonky title. What was the Invisible College, and what do you mean by the New Invisible College?
The Invisible College is the term that's often used to describe the very earliest times of what we think of as modern science. So if you think of modern science as beginning in the 17th century in Europe, the original folks who basically found each other through a network of interaction, trying to identify other people, like-minded thinkers and so on, began to collect together and realize that they were approaching knowledge creation and thinking about knowledge in a similar way by experimentation. So one of them coined the term Invisible College and said, we're like an invisible college operating outside of academia. At the time, the scholastics ran all of academia, and they were very much based on a kind of an Aristotelian worldview. Mm-hmm. So these new experimenters, who weren't just British, even though this began in London, called themselves this Invisible College and were really quite revolutionary in their way. So the way we came up with the idea of the new Invisible College is by recognizing that during the 1990s and the early 2000s, the world system of science has really changed in revolutionary ways. And yet, the way in which we make and create knowledge hasn't changed. Mm-hmm. It's still in the process of interaction, external experimentation, and checking of facts and passing that information along, but the structure and organization of that has changed. Mm. And actually, the very first title I started with was called Science Beyond the Nation State. That was my first working title, because what I was trying to do is show that we've moved science now beyond the nation state. But as we got into working, I worked with the editor at the Brookings Institution, and we were really basing it on the concept of a network structure. And so we got into this and said, well, you know, this is really a lot like the very first days of science. So in a way, science has moved from this very elusive network of people in the 17th century through kind of a period of professionalization through, I think, in the 20th century, a time of national systems where nations captured science in a way and thought of it as a national asset.
Talk about that some more. You point out in a very interesting way that for example, the Jefferson's Patent Statute, this notion of intellectual property sort of evolved. It was in the individuals, but then it became the property, as you say, of the nation state. So what are you implying about the future of intellectual property in your views?
This is such a fascinating topic. Really, I think one of the big questions in science policy of our time is how to deal with this question of intellectual property. We come from an era and a long time in which the ideas that you created were considered to be, to some extent, yours. And people claimed some rights over their own ideas. And I'd really love to do another book on intellectual property of the future, because even in the book I say, I think we're coming into a post-patent era.
Yes.
I think we are moving beyond the time when individuals will claim ownership over ideas. Because really, even in our own lifetimes, we've moved from a time when we had knowledge scarcity, and it was hard to find information. You had to cobble it together through a great deal of effort. And we've moved into a time of knowledge abundance.
Yes.
And a time when I think people like Eric von Hippel at MIT point out that we're really being driven, that a lot of innovation is being driven by the user.
Mm-hmm.
So as we move in that direction, and if my vision that I propose in the book, in which we have much more expansion of science into developing countries, I think that this is going to break loose this concept that there's ownership over knowledge and ideas. And I think, sadly, some industries are still very, very, very stuck in this idea that we really have to have ownership of ideas. But I think over the next 50 years, my feeling is that we'll move beyond that.
And obviously, we'll, somehow, entrepreneurs will have to find new ways of capturing the value, but it'll be much harder to say exactly what belongs to them according to some Lockean labor theory of value, right?
Right.
As this goes through the system. I thought found that to be very provocative and probably should be the subject of another book. And we'll have you back for that. I want to go back to the systems concept that underlies the book, which I should say was published by Brookings and is available and visible on the web in the usual ways. Talk about the idea of a complex adaptive system. That's the technical term that you use in the book. What is a complex adaptive system, and you know, what are some metaphors that people who don't know about this could think of to understand what they're like? And how does that apply to science?
Okay, there's a number of things there. One is that complex adaptive systems are around us everywhere, and so we're intuitively aware of them. Mother Nature, the invisible hand, the financial crises we're dealing with, these are all parts of complex adaptive systems that in which we interact all the time. So in some ways, I think the good thing about this is that intuitively we know what they are. But they are complex in the sense that there are many different interacting pieces of it. And it's adaptive in that each piece of that system can adapt itself or change as it looks around its environment, even if it's not a conscious, like an atom will adapt, for example. But it will adapt to the environment in which it is. And it's a system in that there's a number of levels. So the great thing is that physicists have recently, over the last 15 or 20 years, and partly because of our ability to use high-end computers to model these systems, have found that complex adaptive systems operate by underlying probabilities and regulations and rules. And to me, that opens up for us in the modern time when we're dealing with so many systems at so many levels, really like a world of opportunity to help to not govern these systems, because you can't govern a complex adaptive system.
By definition, I guess. Right,
right. Yeah. Right. And that's what we're finding even with the world financial system we're watching.
Exactly. Yeah.
A system where you can only regulate and incentivize the behaviors that you would like to see. And so it seems to me that, as I've suggested in the book, that if we have moved science beyond these national systems, and that now we're really dealing with a global system, and the nations still exist and they still play in this system, but really we're governed by the global system, that now what we need to do is learn from complex adaptive system structures to say, what do we want that system to look like? Mm-hmm. Just as in the financial system, we know it doesn't necessarily always turn out in an optimal way. You do have to provide incentives and guide and nudge that system in different directions. And I believe that's the same for science. We shouldn't just let science run rampant. We need to find ways to target that science and help to move it, especially, I think, to help the poor, help people in poor countries to join this system. So I think we do need to govern it, but we can't control it.
I mean, there's quite a debate about this, as you know, among people interested in science policy on left and right. We both know that there are libertarian writers who really think that government needs to get completely out of the business of even funding science, and that would take government out of the role to a great extent, I guess, of regulating science as well. So say a little bit more about your reaction to that view. And I guess as we're looking toward a new administration in Washington, which is going to be very limited in terms of the extent to which it can fund new science, particularly basic research, what is your approach, counsel, about the role of government in science as against letting a thousand flowers bloom?
Well, if you look first, I think you have to start with why did government fund science to begin with? And one, of course, and it still remains, is the defense and military aspects of science, which will remain. And the second is that in some cases, science is just too expensive for any single entity to fund. And who has big treasuries? Governments. And that's exactly how governments started out funding science in the 19th century. And then in the 20th century, we saw that well, and rightly so, if the public is paying for it, they want to know what they're getting for it. And therefore, government kept saying, well, what are we getting for this kind of investment? Mm. So that part of science funding, the need for large-scale funding, the attachment of science to the military and so on, that probably will remain part of the system in the future. But at the end of the book, I say, if we're going to govern science in the 21st century, one of the changes we should seek is to remove science funding out of the interests of nations alone. That really what we ought to be doing, anybody who wants to fund science should fund simply the best science. Mm-hmm. Merit only. And that would mean that if you are in Canada and you receive a proposal from Argentina, you consider it equally, because the knowledge provided and created should be available then to others, mm-hmm. and should be able to diffuse into the system. So my suggestion would be, while it requires quite a significant change over time, is that we move much more towards an open system of funding science, and that governments provide funding into that system, but offer it blindly, that they're not going to say, we're providing this so that you will do vaccine research in, AIDS or something like that. That it's provided into a system in which, like almost a Rawlsian system, where, you know, you just put that money in, it's blind, and then out of that, what governments should do, I think, is seek to bring knowledge back home. How to mm-hmm. make any knowledge from anywhere locally useful.
And a critical part of that diffusion, maybe definitive of the diffusion, is publication, right? And so, of course, there's this tension right now between the people who want to replicate sort of the public library concept, where there's open access, and the publishers who have been very concerned about and have other arguments about the importance of, they would say, maintaining quality of publication through a publication review process and so forth that they have provided. What's your view of open access? What does open access do in this system? Is it necessary to fulfill your vision, or is it only one way to do that?
Well, what's interesting right now is that there are many different experiments out there already mm-hmm. to test different ways of doing this. India, for example, has made most of its journals freely available online mm-hmm. in order to encourage knowledge diffusion. In the physics community, they have archives online where mm-hmm. people can post work in progress. And the interesting thing is similar to these kinds of web voting systems where somebody puts some work online and, you know, you can come on and, yes, I like it, no, I don't, or yes, this is good, no, it mm-hmm. isn't. There's a lot of problems with that outside of individual disciplines of yeah. science, because if I'm not a physicist and I'm reading that
It's one of the wiki problems.
Right, exactly. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And if your friends and family go on and vote 100 times, you know, right. then you're going to get a skewed voting system. Yeah. So there's still a need for peer review, clearly, in this global system. At the same time, there's also this need, continual need, for access. And from the point of view of the developing countries, access is critical. It's going to be their lifeblood, and it is right now one of the great barriers to their entering the science system.
Yeah, and you point out that there are really, 15 or 20 countries that do 90% of the science. It's expensive to get into the International Science Club. But what I thought was really interesting, one of the most interesting points you make in the book, is that the Internet has not necessarily been the driver of access. Explain that, because based on the other things that you're talking about, you know, knowledge diffusion, you would think it has been very important in helping the have-nots kind of get into the science community. But you say that really wasn't what was critical in the 90s.
Right. In fact, it's counterintuitive, isn't it?
Yeah.
This came out of work I was doing, actually, for the World Bank, because the bank wanted to just lay fiber optic cable all over Africa in the hopes of bringing African scientists into the global system. And what we found when we actually, this is work I did for the RAND Corporation, what we found when we got into it is that, indeed, this system is not flat. like the Thomas Friedman concept, that only if you just could gain access, you'd be in. And this is where the network concept becomes so important, and the really fascinating work done by people like Laszlo Barabasi and Mark Newman come into play in understanding the science system. It is not an open, it is an open system in the sense that new people can come in, but it's not flat in the sense that I can just pick up the phone and, you know, call Einstein, you know, and, and get access to collaboration with that person. In fact, it's a very highly structured system, and the structure itself and the way in which interaction happens is invisible. Which is why we get back to this concept of this new invisible college. The rules by which people operate within science, the way in which they come into and operate within the system, is pretty much invisible to those outside of that system, and especially to people in developing countries who, when I was working with the White House Science Office, people would come and say, we want to sign an agreement with the United States in science so that we can have access to the science
system. That's not the way it works, exactly.
No, and it's heartbreaking in a way because you know that these people want to break into the system, but if they don't understand the rules, the norms, the nomenclature that goes along with it, they can't get in.
So the other point that you make that is also sort of counterintuitive in considering the diffusion that's possible now of information electronically is that to a very great extent, although the college is invisible to people sort of who are on the outside, but the insiders, people who rub elbows with each other, who's in somebody's lab, you know, may be very important 10 years down the road, and who their students are and who their students' students are. So there's this old-fashioned sort of sociometry of science that that continues, that contributes to its invisibility if you're not part of it. Is that fair to say?
Yes.
Yeah. And if you're, you know, in a underdeveloped country, you may be a very good scientist, but you don't have access to those kinds of relationships necessarily. And you also point out that the fall of the Berlin Wall, the end of the Cold War, had a lot to do with getting very smart people from Central Europe and from Russia back into the system because they could then go to international meetings much more easily.
Right. Yeah, if you look at the network structures, they explode into the system in the 90s and really shake it up so tremendously that it fundamentally alters the physics of that system. But the thing that we found in developing countries is that most of the time, the people doing science in those countries are doing excellent science. Most of the time, their connections are with people outside of their own country. So there are people, for example, that I've interviewed in Uganda who are working with their colleagues in Sussex University in England. And so while they are part of an invisible college, the ability of the knowledge then to diffuse locally is so limited.
Very limited.
Yeah, because the connections and the connectivity locally just aren't there.
So the Ghana may not benefit from the work that's being done, but the UK may benefit.
Exactly.
We're now in the midst of this financial crisis, which looks like we're going to be in the midst of it for years to come. My understanding is that that scientific innovation doesn't necessarily lead to the end of an acute financial crisis, that it takes 20, 30 years. Correct me if I'm wrong, but that's what people who looked at these things and have talked to me about these things say. If I say, how does science, what's the argument for science, technology, innovation, next administration? Can we say it'll help to bootstrap us out of this crisis? Well, not really. That takes much longer for that to bear fruit. So, what does the new invisible college have to offer us in terms of guidelines for, you know, doing science policy, investing in science, in the midst of this unprecedented period in which capitalism, some of the fundamental notions of one kind of capitalism anyway, seem to be at risk?
Well, there's a couple parts there. I think one is the question of the extent to which or the time that it takes for a new idea or an innovation to enter common usage in the marketplace. So that's one place where, indeed, it shows that that cycle can take 15 to 30 years time, depending on the innovation, the scale and scope of the production and so on required in order to get an innovation into the marketplace. On the other end of that, though, science is really very good at solving problems, at solving even local problems. So, for example, the work I did on the UN Millennium Development Task Force, we were looking at the Millennium Development Goals and trying to identify ways in which science and technology could help to solve those problems now. Hmm. Clean water, maternal health, getting textbooks to students who need them. These are critical needs that will transcend any financial crisis and really, I think, contribute to global stability and that eventually contribute to the reduction of war and all kinds of things.
What our colleague here at American Progress at UC Berkeley, Tom Khalil, calls weapons of mass salvation.
Yes.
Is what you're talking
Tom
about.
Tom is a good friend.
Yeah.
So, is exactly right. If we need to rethink science. Mm-hmm. We tended to think of science as the trip to the moon, as the AIDS vaccine.
The iPhone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And these are beautiful things, and I love them too.
Yeah.
But science, we have now, the great thing about now as opposed to even 100 years ago, different times and when we've had economic crises, is that we have this cadre of knowledge now. We can't lose it. It's so critical to our potential as a civilization. So we have this knowledge. We can use it if we can make it available so that people can solve problems locally.
And it's not necessarily big science that you're talking about. It's relatively modest investments using the knowledge base we have and taking it a step or two forward, not blue sky stuff, but stuff that we have specific questions and we know how to get the answers, and it doesn't take a big investment.
Right. And in fact, one of the great unsung songs or stories of scientific success is the Agricultural Extension Service in the United States. It is a case where local loops and experimentation and integrating learning as very sequentially over time, and that information gets diffused. These are beautiful examples and shouldn't be lost on us. We're focusing on, you know, are we funding the greatest physics ever? Let's look at funding. How do we make individual people's lives better?
And some political scientists say that one of the reasons that there's a strong core of progressives in the Midwest on the farms is because they see government in action in these in the way that the best agricultural science is brought to them routinely from government officials in the county.
Right. Yeah. So I think science policy now should focus on local learning. Local learning and feed it back in and make it a feedback loop. Hopefully we don't lose the internet. It's a great tool.
Yeah, yeah.
And it is a way in which people can use this knowledge. Think of it as knowledge that can solve local problems.
Well, Caroline Wagner, this has been a great conversation. There's a lot more to talk about, but we're going to have to leave it here for now. We've been talking to Caroline Wagner, who is a senior analyst at SRI International and the author of The New Invisible College, published by Brookings. You can find it on the internet, which we do still have as of the moment of this podcast. Thank you very much, Caroline, and please come back and talk to us again.
Thank you so much, Jonathan. It's really been a pleasure.
Thank you.